You're listening to the Restless Wanderer podcast by Paul Coulter, and this is part 26 of a series in Matthew's Gospel. Matthew chapter 15, verse 29. Jesus went on from there and walked beside the Sea of Galilee. And he went up on the mountain and sat down there. And great crowds came to him, bringing with them the lame, the blind, the crippled, the mute, and many others. And they put them at his feet, and he healed them. So that the crowd wondered when they saw the mute speaking, the crippled healthy, the lame walking, and the blind seeing, and they glorified the God of Israel. Then Jesus called his disciples to him and said, I have compassion on the crowd because they have been with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat, and I am unwilling to send them away hungry lest they faint on the way. And the disciples said to him, Where are we going to get enough bread in such a desolate place to feed so great a crowd? And Jesus said to them, How many loaves do you have? They said, Seven and a few small fish. And directing the crowd to sit down on the ground, he took the seven loaves and the fish, and having given thanks, he broke them and gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the crowds. And they all ate and were satisfied, and they took up seven baskets full of the broken pieces left over. Those who ate were 4,000 men, besides women and children, and after sending away the crowds, he got into the boat and went to the region of Magadan. We'll pause there, our reading after verse 39, the end of Matthew chapter 15. Now, I don't want to comment too much in this passage because we really need to read into the next chapter to see what Jesus says about the feeding of the 4,000. Simply to say that, contrary to some claims, this is not the same event. Some people might say, well, there were kind of different memories that Matthew was putting together, and some people remembered 5,000 and some people remembered 4,000, and this is just the same event. That would both be very strange if Matthew was recording in the very next chapter the same event, but with a different number of people. But also when we get into chapter 16, we'll see that Jesus there contrasts these two events, the feeding of 5,000 and the feeding of 4,000, they're two different occasions that are meant to teach different lessons to the disciples. But what I simply want to say is that here the feeding of the 4,000 is prefaced in verses 29 to 31 with this statement about the people that Jesus healed. And you'll notice in verses 30 and 31, Matthew records the same list. He says, great crowds came bringing with them the lame, the blind, the crippled, the mute. And again in verse 31, the mute, the crippled, the lame, and the blind. Four categories of people. And although Matthew doesn't tell us that he's alluding to an Old Testament prophecy, we read in Isaiah 35, verse 5, then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, the ears of the deaf unstopped, then shall the lame man leap like a deer, and the tongue of the mute sing for joy. So you have four categories of people there. That's not exactly the same as in Matthew's record in Matthew 15. So in Matthew, you have the lame, the blind, the crippled, and the mute. In Isaiah, you have the blind, the deaf, the lame, and the mute. So the deaf have been substituted with the crippled in Matthew, but it's very clearly a resonance from the same Old Testament passage. And of course, the context of that is of the redemption of God's people, of the messianic age, when the desert will bloom and the glory of God will be revealed, and people will find strength in God, and there will be no more harm in his new creation. So, These miracles that Jesus is doing are very clearly evidence that he is the Messiah, so much so that Jesus could point to these miracles. You might remember back in Matthew chapter 11, verse 5, he could point to these miracles as evidence for John the Baptist that he, Jesus, was the Messiah. So here Matthew is setting this up, showing us very plainly that Jesus is the Messiah through the miracles that he does, and also through the provision of food for his people, which when we commented on the feeding of the 5,000, we saw was a great statement of Jesus' messianic credentials. But let's read on into Matthew chapter 16. And the Pharisees and Sadducees came, and to test him, they asked him to show them a sign from heaven. He answered them, "When it is evening, you say it will be fair weather, for the sky is red, and in the morning it will be stormy today, for the sky is red and threatening. You know how to interpret the appearance of the sky, but you cannot interpret the signs of the times. An evil and adulterous generation seeks for a sign, but no sign will be given to it except the sign of Jonah." So he left them and departed. When the disciples reached the other side, they had forgotten to bring any bread. Jesus said to them, "Watch and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees." And they began discussing it among themselves, saying, "We brought no bread." But Jesus, aware of this, said, "O you of little faith, why are you discussing among yourselves the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive? Do you not remember the 5 loaves for the 5,000 and how many baskets you gathered? Or the 7 loaves for the 4,000 and how many baskets you gathered? How is it that you fail to understand that I did not speak about bread? Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees." Then they understood that he did not tell them to beware of the leaven of bread, but of the teaching of the Pharisees and Sadducees. We'll pause our reading again there after verse 12 of Matthew chapter 16. Now, there's a great irony. I'm sure you noticed it after my comment on the previous passage at the beginning here of Matthew 16. Here are the Pharisees and Sadducees, and they ask Jesus for a sign from heaven. Now, it's a ridiculous statement after what Matthew has just recorded about the miracles that Jesus were doing, which were exactly the miracles that Isaiah had prophesied in Isaiah 35 would accompany the coming of the Messiah, the Messianic age. The problem was not that they didn't have a sign, but that they refused to follow that sign to its destination. Signs point somewhere. And Jesus says, when it's evening, you know how to read the sky. Of course, that's a familiar saying. I'm sure you're familiar with a version, perhaps in your own context. We would say red sky at night, shepherd's delight, red sky in the morning, sailor's warning. And that's exactly what Jesus recounts here. And people knew that from their observation of nature. And yet the Pharisees didn't know, and the Sadducees, how to interpret the signs of the times. Jesus was doing the very miracles that demonstrated the arrival of the kingdom of God. And yet they looked past those miracles. They didn't see them. In fact, elsewhere, we've seen already, they accused Jesus of doing those signs by the power of the prince of demons. In other words, we will interpret evidence according to what we already believe to be true. Now, this is a big challenge for us because, of course, in our modern age, we like to think that we're rational people and we follow the evidence. We trust in science, for example. But scientists are human like everybody else, and they will interpret their findings according to what they already believe about the universe. They're not going to suggest that God or spiritual powers might be a part of the explanation for something they observe if they don't believe that God and spiritual powers exist. But we all do this all the time, and of course Christians ought to be more discerning than that. Sometimes Christians can be quite gullible as well, just jumping to conclusions about things they see, judging things based on experience rather than being careful to assess the evidence. We all have a bias towards things that confirm what we already believe. Well, the Pharisees and Sadducees had already made up their mind about Jesus. And when they ask this question, of course, that says they're testing him. They want to put him to the test, do a sign on show. And if he doesn't do that, of course, they can say he's not really the Messiah. If he did do it, no doubt, they would say that he was doing it by the power of the devil, as they had before. But Jesus says, an evil and adulterous generation seeks for a sign, but no sign will be given to it except for the sign of Jonah. And here we need to ask a question. What is the sign of Jonah that Jesus speaks about? Well, in order to understand that, we need to remember back to something we've already read in Matthew's gospel back in chapter 12, where Jesus has said, "A wicked and adulterous generation asks for a sign, but none will be given it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. As Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of a huge fish, so the Son of Man will be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth." In other words, the resurrection is the sign of Jonah. That must be what it means in Matthew 16, if that's what Jesus said it meant in Matthew 12. But the tragedy, of course, is that the resurrection itself did not convince those who were hostile to Jesus. It confirmed, when they saw the risen Jesus, to those who had been followers of his, that he truly was alive, that he truly was who he had claimed to be, who his miracles had suggested that he was, God himself incarnate, the creator taking on flesh. But it didn't convince any of those who had rejected Jesus. They didn't see him. Jesus didn't appear to them. And when they heard the reports of an empty tomb, they wouldn't accept it either. They tried to explain it away. This again is concrete proof for us, if you like, that whereas someone might say, well, if God did a miracle or God did this thing for me, I would believe in him, that's not how faith works. Faith is a gift from God, and it's a gift that is received by those who are humble, those who are not prejudging situations, those who are prepared to open their minds to the possibility that they have been wrong, and even to confess that they are wrong, that they are sinners. People like the Pharisees and Sadducees, who have closed minds and hardened hearts, will never be convinced by a sign. They will not. They cannot have faith in the Lord Jesus. Now, Jesus then goes on to talk about the miracles that he had performed. The situation that arises is that the disciples have forgotten to bring bread. Jesus says, watch out for the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees. And the disciples, and I laugh because, not because I'm mocking the disciples in any sense, but because I love the honesty of the gospel accounts. It's one of the things that surely must be evidence that the gospels are not concocted accounts. They're not propaganda, because the disciples often look so foolish, just as you would or I would if we were in the story, because they misunderstand Jesus. They assume, verse 12 tells us, that they were thinking about the leaven of bread, that Jesus was telling them to stick to unleavened bread, not like the Pharisees and Sadducees. But whilst there were times in the Jewish religion when unleavened bread had to be used at the Passover, there was no prohibition on eating bread with leaven. But the Pharisees think, oh, maybe Jesus, that's what he's telling us. Don't eat leavened bread the way others do. So they were discussing it and thinking, well, this is because we brought no bread, verse 7. But they were a bit confused. But Jesus, of course, is trying to teach them something deeper. He's talking about the teaching of the Pharisees and Sadducees, which is hypocritical. And then he reminds them of the number of loaves and the number of baskets in the two miracles, the feeding of the 5,000 and of the 4,000, again telling us that these were two separate events. Now, we need to be careful not to be too speculative about what Jesus is teaching the disciples with these numbers. In one level, the key point that he wants to get across to them is that they should not listen to the teaching of the Pharisees. But there is also something in the significance of these numbers. And that perhaps becomes clearer when we realize that there are two different words that are used here for baskets. So in verse 19, it says, "How many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up?" And the Greek word that is used there, sorry, I'm referring to the wrong reference. I had Mark chapter 8 on my screen there. It's verse 9 and verse 10 in Matthew chapter 16. But the Greek word for basket in Matthew 16 verse 9 is kophonos, which probably means a small sized basket that would have been used as a kind of lunchbox. So that makes sense when you think of the feeding of the 5,000. They got that basket from a boy who had brought his lunch. He didn't bring a large basket. But the word in verse 10 for baskets is a different word, spiritus, which means a large basket. In other words, there was something different between these two miracles. Now, in the first miracle, they picked up 12 lunchbox-sized baskets. And that's telling them what? Well, it's telling them that God will provide individually for their needs as they serve him. That was the lesson we picked up from the feeding of the 5,000. But now with the feeding of the 4,000, there is an abundance of leftovers, more than they could eat, 7 large baskets full of food. And so that's telling us that there is an abundant provision of God, more than we could ever need. So at the very least, these two different numbers and the fact that they're different types of baskets are telling them something about God's provision. He provides exactly what each person needs, and his provision is abundant. It never runs out. But perhaps Jesus is telling them something more than this as well. He's, of course, reminding them that they can trust in him. The fact that they've forgotten to bring bread is not an obstacle to God sustaining them. He could provide for them miraculously, but also that his provision through these signs is a sign of who he is as the provider, the very point that the Pharisees cannot and have not seen. Well, there might be another dimension as well to these numbers, because there are 12 baskets the first time. That's telling us about the 12 tribes, or it's bound to make us think about the 12 tribes of Israel, just as there were 12 apostles for that reason. A new beginning, a new people of Israel, beginning with these 12 men. But the number 7 is the number of completeness and perfection. It's the number of days in the week, which goes back long before God chose one nation to be his own. But also there is an abundance in those baskets. So I think there's also a symbolism here that Jesus is pointing out, that the mission that has begun with these disciples is going to expand to the Gentiles, just as we know is coming in Matthew. We've seen other pointers towards that, and that will reach its fulfillment in Matthew 28, when the risen Jesus commissions the disciples to go and make the apostles, to make disciples of all nations. So, if they are going to be part of that mission of God, they will have to avoid the teaching of the Pharisees and Sadducees, who were both dismissing the reality that their Messiah had come, but who also were resistant to the idea of God's blessing spilling over abundantly to those who they judged to be sinners, and especially to the Gentiles. Let's read on then, Matthew 16, verse 13. Now, when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do you say that the Son of Man is?" And they said, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter replied, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." Then he strictly charged the disciples to tell no one that he was the Christ. We'll pause there after verse 20 of Matthew 16. Now, this is a crucial turning point in Jesus' ministry. Up to this point, the question for the disciples has been, "Who do you say that I am?" The question that Jesus directly asked them in verse 15. Who is Jesus? They have come to realize, as Peter says, that he is the Christ. The miracles have convinced them, the wisdom of his teaching, the purity of his character, no doubt. These things together have convinced them. Of course, the Pharisees and Sadducees were blind to it. They rejected the possibility. But Peter, by divine revelation revealed to him by the Father, is the first to recognize that that's who Jesus is. That happens in the district of Caesarea Philippi. It's a predominantly Gentile area. The town, of course, Caesarea is a name from the title of the Roman emperors. Philip is a Greek name from the father of Alexander the Great. It's not named after Philip of Macedon, but after Philip the Tetrarch, who was one of the Herodian family. But it's a predominantly Gentile area. There were other Caesareas around, Caesarea Maritima, which was the Roman administrative capital. And so it's called Caesarea Philippi, named after Philip the Tetrarch, the son of Herod. The city was founded by him in 3 BC. But anyway, it's predominantly a Gentile area, and it's the appropriate place for Jesus to ask a question. Who are people saying that the Son of Man is, that he is? And they respond with some of the popular theories on the street. Some say he was John the Baptist come back from the dead. Others say he's Elijah. They had said the same about John, of course. Others say Jeremiah or one of the prophets. So generally speaking, people are believing that Jesus has come from God. But Jesus doesn't leave it with general chit-chat. He asks, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter, as often the bold one, the one who speaks up, said, "You're the Christ, the Son of the living God." Now, calling him the Son of the living God is probably not a declaration of deity. We might read it that way and think that Peter has recognized that Jesus is God incarnate. It's almost certainly the case that it wasn't until after the resurrection and reflecting on it that people like Peter recognized that to be true. He did recognize it. He does reflect that certainly in his letters and I think in his preaching in Acts as well. But at this point, calling him the Son of the Living God is probably simply saying that he is the true king, because the kings of Israel in the Psalms particularly are called sons of God. So it is a strong declaration that Jesus is the Messiah, the anointed one, the Christ, the promised King of Israel. And Jesus receives that and says, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah." Bar means son of Jonah, or son of John. We would say Simon Johnson, an everyday sort of name. That was Simon's birth name. That was Peter's birth name, Simon. The fact that we know him as Simon Peter in verse 16 calls him that flows from what Jesus says to him next. He says, "Flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." Peter is no longer going to be known, or Simon is no longer going to be known by the name of his father, which was a common way to identify. Simon was a very common name. Some scholars say the most common name amongst first century Jews. And so it was very common to say, "Though, which Simon do you mean?" Well, it's Simon the son of Jonah, or Simon who fulfills that profession. They didn't have surnames the way we would today, or Simon from that town or this town. So it wasn't a surname so much as just an identifier to help you distinguish which person you were talking about. But this Simon, son of Jonah, is now going to be known as Peter. In one sense, it's a nickname. Jesus seems to have given nicknames to a number of his disciples. But in another sense, it becomes his given name, the name that he's known by to history. So this is probably more like God changing the name of Jacob to Israel, or of Abram to Abraham. It's something that God does on occasions in the scriptures to signify a new identity in his purpose. In first century Judaism, names were given more weight than they are sometimes today by Westerners. The parents would think very carefully about what to name a child. They would choose the name sometimes from the family tradition, or sometimes to signify a quality that they thought they saw in the newborn child, or in some cases that they prayed and hoped the child would have. In a few cases, of course, in scripture, a quality that God had said the child would have. Well, Jesus here gives Peter his new name, gives Simon his new name, Peter, which sounds like the word rock. And then he says, "On this rock I will build my church." Now, there has been much debate about this verse. Some people will say that Jesus isn't calling Peter the rock, but he's calling his declaration of faith in Jesus the rock. But I think we're saying too much when we say that. People want to stress that because there is a Roman Catholic tradition that says this is why Peter is the Pope, and that the popes inherit Peter's authority as the foundation of the rock, or of the church rather. But that's going way beyond what the verse says. Peter is being called the rock. He is the rock on which Jesus will build his church. Why do I say that? Because when you get to the New Testament epistles, you see this idea coming through. So you see in Ephesians, the Apostle Paul describes the apostles and prophets as the foundation of the church. That's in Ephesians chapter 2, verse 20. But Jesus is the cornerstone, Ephesians 2, 20 says. In other words, there is a sense in which Peter is the first foundation stone to be laid. But he's not the first stone of all. That's the cornerstone, which is Jesus. So Peter is the first stone to be laid next to Jesus. He's the stone, that the first one to line up with who Jesus is. And Peter picks this image up himself in 1 Peter chapter 2. There he quotes the Old Testament talking about a stone that God has laid, and that stone is Jesus, the cornerstone, the same idea that we've just seen in Ephesians 2. But Peter says, you too, as you come to him, 1 Peter 2 verse 4, a living stone rejected by men, but in the sight of God chosen and precious, you yourselves, like living stones, are being built up as a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. In other words, what Peter is saying is that all of those who follow in his example of faith in Jesus become living stones built into the church that God is building. The foundation layer was the apostles and the prophets, those who received the word directly from Jesus. Peter was the first one to be laid down. He is a leader amongst the apostles. We see that even in the fact that he's the one who speaks up, as is so often the case. But he doesn't have authority over the apostles. He and the apostles together are under the authority of Jesus. They are lining up with him, and the authority that they have as apostles is given to them by Jesus. All authority belongs to him, Jesus says, Matthew 28, and then he commissions them to go and to make disciples. So in saying that Peter is the rock, which is the natural reading of verse 18, we're not in any sense establishing Peter as the Pope. He is the first of the apostles, a leader amongst them, but he is one of them. And it's Jesus who is the authority with which Peter has lined up, and with which the others must line up as they too come to believe in Jesus. But apart from that, even if Peter was in some sense a pope-like figure, the idea of the succession of the authority of the apostles is just simply false. The authority of the apostles we receive through their writings, the New Testament letters and books which they wrote or whose writing they superintended. So the authority of Peter and the other apostles didn't get passed on to bishops after them and then to multiple generations of bishops. It's recorded for us in Scripture. We are under the authority of God through his word. Jesus, though, promises to build his church, and this is very significant, Matthew 16, verse 18. Matthew is the only gospel where we read the word church, or Greek ekklesia. We have it twice here in chapter 16 and again in chapter 18. But when we get to chapter 28, we'll see that there are parallels between Jesus' statement here and what he says to the apostles in his Great Commission that are reminding us, although he doesn't use the word church there, that it's the church that he is going to build, that he's not simply interested in calling individuals to be disciples, but in forming a community. That word ecclesia is used in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, and it there refers to the gathering. It's from the Hebrew word kahal, translated as ecclesia, the gathering of God's people. So in common Greek usage, it could refer simply to a crowd or to an assembly of people for a purpose. That purpose might be political or commercial or a riot or a protest or a spectacle they have come to watch. But here specifically, Jesus is using it of his church. With the Old Testament resonance, the community of Israel was the covenant people of God gathered together under him and to worship him. And the church that Jesus will build is now his church, a new community in relationship to him. We'll see in chapter 18 that Jesus says, "Where two or three are gathered, there I am in the midst." That, in a sense, is the basic essence of the church. A group of people, even two or three, gathered together under Jesus to worship him, in which Jesus is present. But there's slightly more than that in the verses that we're reading here, because it's also got to do with the foundation that Jesus is laying of the apostles. Verse 19, Jesus says, "I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." This is really important because the idea of binding and loosing was a common phrase, I'm led to understand, amongst the teachers, the rabbis of Jesus' day. When a rabbi interpreted the law and said, "You should do this or you should not do that," he was binding and loosing. So he was either saying, you are bound, you should not do that, or you are loose, you are free to do that. That's how rabbis interpreted the law. And in the same sense, it is the apostles who will have the authority to interpret the teaching of Jesus. So it's not simply that the church is just a group of people who gather together to worship Jesus, who are believers in him, with whom he is present, whilst that is true. But the church is a community of people consciously built on the foundation of the apostles, under the authority of their teaching, and with proper leadership that keeps them faithful to that teaching. Now, I'm not saying to be a church you have to have elders or leaders or pastors. You see in the Acts of the Apostles, the first churches didn't have elders initially, but it was a priority for the apostles, including Peter and others in Jerusalem, and also Paul and his co-workers in other locations, to make sure that they appointed elders, overseers of the church, teachers who could keep it true to the gospel. So the church doesn't have to have leaders to be the church, but it is for the health and good of the church that it does have. And therefore a church ought to have godly elders, godly pastors who are teaching it, who are keeping it faithful to the gospel, who recognize the authority of the word of God and know how to teach it. And then verse 20, he strictly charged the disciples to tell no one that he was the Christ. Here is one of the mysteries. In fact, it is the messianic mystery, that just as the disciples have realized who Jesus is, Jesus tells them not to tell others. But I'll pick that up at the beginning of the next episode as to why that might be, and as we read on to the end of Matthew 16.